Welcome to Vice Casting Couch, Season 1, Episode 21. I'm Ryan, joining me is John, and today we're going to talk about Apple vulnerable to worms and getting sued as well by the EU, and Google also getting sued. We're going to go over that and maybe some other stories as well. How you doing, John?
I'm doing pretty good, man.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Feeling all right?
Oh, I'm feeling fantastic.
Okay. So I'm going to start with the Google getting sued here.
All right.
So I thought this was pretty interesting. There's about four people who came forward and said that they were going to sue Google. The reason they were going to sue is over Google allegedly stealing their data from them. Not what you would think, like the normal, you know, Google spying on you and, you know, taking all your cookies and stuff. This one is, they proved that Google takes about, on average, 260 megabits a month of your data plan to send them data from your phone. So the reason that they're suing, the grounds, is that this is nowhere, the customer does not agree to this at all. In the terms and conditions, you agree to this, you agree to them taking your data when you use their products, but when you're not using their products, obviously you don't agree to them just using your data basically to profit off of it and send back info that they can use. So this was filed November 12th, 2020. According to pacemonitor.com, it's being categorized under personal property and then subcategory personal property damage. So they're trying to prove here, or at least stating, that your data plan, once you pay for it, it is your property. Google is essentially stealing it without permission, which I find interesting because I haven't really thought of your data plan that way as some sort of personal property. Several states are also bringing this case under, they're filing this, I don't know if filing is the correct term, but they're categorizing this under Section 2 of the Sherman Act, which deals with anti-monopolies and like antitrust and stuff like that. So after this goes through, I don't know much about, you know, the legal side. My expertise kind of stops at like digital forensics. Like that's about as far as I know anything about the legality of this. To me, that seems like kind of a big deal that other states are taking notice of this, and also that they are kind of looking at this as a anti-monopoly. So maybe if Google does get charged, criminally charged, perhaps other states are going to pick this up and run with it. The people that are suing, they also requested a trial by jury, which I found really interesting because I wasn't exactly sure what that entailed. But usually these kind of matters are settled in like with a plea deal or not a plea deal, but they're like settled out of court. You know, the Google will just, you know, whatever, pay them a couple $1,000 or whatever, and they'll shut up.
Yeah, like arbitration.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so they're requesting a trial by jury. So I asked a friend of mine who's in the legal field what exactly that means, and they said that sometimes when the plaintiff requests a trial by jury, sometimes that can force the defendant to offer a much higher price because otherwise it forces them to go to court and basically be, you know, judged by a jury. So judged by other people rather than just, you know, an actual judge ruling on the case. So I thought that was kind of interesting. So they may just be trying to leverage more money out of Google, or they may be kind of going the high road in this scenario, basically saying like, no, we're not going to take any like offer. We're taking this to court. So yeah, I thought that was pretty interesting. I haven't seen any date be set in stone as to when this will actually be heard, so I'm not sure when the updates will come out. But there is a let me pull up the site here. Okay, it is pacermonitor.com. Obviously, we'll put everything in the description as well as a copy of the court case and everything like that. But yeah, pacermonitor.com also has updates on what's actually happening with this case. So I'll post that as well if you want to look into it and see what actually happens with it. But I thought that was pretty interesting. What do you think?
I think it's a very interesting perspective to take on data plans. You know, and it does make sense. Not everyone has unlimited. So, like, say if I only pay for 6 gigabytes a month, like, if Google is using it while you're not using the app, it is kind of suspicious, but I wonder how they're going to argue it. Was the app running in the background? Was it not running at all? Like,
yeah, so they brought a Samsung phone. This is how they like proved their case or whatever. They brought a Samsung phone in. They ran some tests on it. They closed out all the Google apps, and they showed that over a course of a month, on average, or however long they tested it for, on average, it was about 260 megabits that Google was transmitting between the phone, obviously using the data that the person had paid for, without any Google apps open. So this was purely just statistics and analytics being sent back to Google, and you know, updates and stuff being sent back to the phone. So yeah, we'll see how the case goes, but supposedly they have claimed that they have proved that Google has misappropriated these people's data by basically just using their data plan, running off their data plan to gather info.
Well, and hopefully this kind of brings to light how much they actually do track. Well, 200 megabytes, or megabits doesn't, 260 megabytes doesn't sound like a much. Metadata and the information they collect that can ultimately reveal a lot of personal information does not have to be large. And you know, while you're not even using the app, it's very suspicious. And I hope that this, sheds more light on this issue that happens by not only Google, but Facebook and Apple to an extent. Maybe we'll see something go in the right direction, but who knows?
Yeah, I definitely hope so. And yeah, I agree. Like, yeah, 200 megabits, it's not a lot. It's just kind of the principle of it. But also, so I was looking into it, and there are a lot of programs that give out free phones with sort of a limited plan to people that wouldn't be able to afford them. So maybe like people that are, homeless or just.
Yeah, this would be extremely, this could, that 200 megabytes could actually be quite a lot for someone who is of lower income who do get these subsidized phone plans and or free phone plans.
Exactly. So, if they're given a phone plan with 1 or 2 gigs of data and then, they need that for an emergency or whatever. And, too bad. Like, you use some and then Google took the rest. So,
well, especially with what we're seeing with more stuff going completely online, like there's fully online banks. Like I know Ally Bank's a huge one. Capital One, while they have some locations, isn't that big. Various other ones like Marcus, by Goldman Sachs, it's completely online. That 200 megabytes could be used for someone transferring their money, like say like you said, if emergency came up and they had to pay their bills. I could see how this could be detrimental to some areas or sections of our society.
No, I definitely agree. As you brought up with the banking, but a lot of stuff is purely online now. And a lot of it is essential. I mean, paying bills and stuff, some places they don't let you send cash anymore or, a money order or what have you. Sometimes you have to pay it online. And if you can't use the data that you paid for because Google decided that they were just going to, gather ad info from you, yeah, I could definitely see why they'd be upset.
Speaking of Google, so there is a Google hacker who discovered a zero-click wormable Wi-Fi exploit for iPhones. And so Google Project Zero, we've discussed them in the past. They kind of release these 0 days and different exploits by different security researchers. Security researcher Ian Beer, he disclosed these details of something that is now patched, is a critical iOS bug that made it possible for a remote attacker to gain complete control of any device within vicinity over Wi-Fi. So this wormable exploit, it's kind of interesting. It propagates, using Wi-Fi, and it can use the radio proximity to exploit and further a spread from one nearby device to another, once again with no user interaction needed. With complete control of your device, they can view your photos, they can read all your emails, copy private messages, monitor everything which happens on the device in real time. For the people who are interested, there is a CVE code. It's CVE-2020-3843. And it was addressed by Apple in some security updates that were updated earlier this year. Looking into it, it's interesting. They use the Apple Wireless Direct Link technology, which is used for like AirDrop and AirPlay. Yeah, and it does this what they say is a fairly trivial buffer overflow programming error in the Wi-Fi driver, which enables it to make these like connections between your devices when you do AirDrop and whatnot.
So that's how it propagates?
Yes, this Wi-Fi driver that has a buffer overflow.
Okay.
It's called Apple Wireless Direct Link. It's their proprietary mesh networking protocol.
Gotcha. Okay.
The security researchers used an iPhone 11 Pro, a Raspberry Pi, and then two different Wi-Fi adapters to achieve this kernel memory read and write remotely. They leveraged to inject shellcode payloads into the kernel memory via victim process, which then escapes the sandbox protections that Apple has. Because Apple, believe it or not, actually has very good security. They're pretty hardened. You know, they're not open source, which is a downside. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there is a reason why the U.S. government and, like, many other places strictly use iPhones.
Yeah, it makes sense. They do some things right.
But I thought this was extremely interesting because if it's wormable and can spread from device to device with no user interaction, who knows how many devices this could have infected, and it can literally access everything on the device.
Yeah, so that was my question earlier, how it propagates. So it using that driver, what does it then do to go to another phone? Is it using the like the AirDrop method, and it just connects to another phone? Because there should
be some exploits that Apple Wireless Direct Link, which is kind of, it says it's built into the Wi-Fi driver associated with that technology.
Okay.
Right, which then they do a buffer overflow, and then it says the attacker targets the AirDrop BTLE framework to enable that Apple Wireless Direct Link interface by brute forcing the contact's hash value from a list of 100 randomly generated contacts stored in the phone. And then it exploits the buffer overflow to gain access to the device, and then it runs an implant as root, giving malicious party full control over everything.
Gotcha. Okay. All right, yeah, I was just trying to connect like how exactly it's getting to another phone. But yeah, that makes sense.
So I think it sounds like you need that setup like they were talking about with the Raspberry Pi and the iPhone 11 Pro initially to do all that. And then once it gets into once they can do the exploit once, it can then spread from there.
Is there any, did they mention any ETIC for when it would be patched or
done? Oh, they already patched it earlier this year. They did. So with iOS 13.3.1, macOS Catalina 10.15.3, and then watchOS 5.3.7.
Gotcha.
Okay. It was all patched, yeah.
All right. So as always, make sure you update your stuff.
Oh, for sure.
I know it's annoying, especially on devices like Windows, but...
Well, I've noticed I've used an iPhone begrudgingly. but it seems to update, like it'll update when I'm asleep automatically.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. If it's plugged in and has Wi-Fi connection, it'll just update. And it'll be like, hey, we've updated to this. And I was kind of like, well, you could have at least told me, like,
I want, you know, be beforehand. Asked.
Yeah, exactly.
I want to at least be asked.
Don't make them drink the tea.
Oh no. Yeah. I think Windows has like they have like the active hours and like that sort of stuff, which does help. But if it's like a hot fix or something like that, they'll just push it out. It'll just pop up in the corner and be like, hey, you're going to be restarted.
Well, to me, this makes me question like how much control do I actually have over my device? Mm-hmm. And, you know, me personally, I'd like the option. I'd like to be notified beforehand, and have the option to not update. Especially when more questionable updates are being pushed that include various other software that I don't know if I fully agree with, you know.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. On Windows with all the freaking bloatware and stuff that it updates, like.
I'm looking at you, Candy Crush Saga.
Every freaking time.
I hate
that game because it's always on there.
Mm-hmm. But you uninstall it, do another feature update. Oh, it's back. Who would have thought? Oh, that's strange.
Yeah, even if you... Well, since I... Actually, I don't know. I'll have to check. Since I removed the actual like app package from Windows, I don't know if it's come back.
I'll have to look into that. But the problem I see with that, because I've done this at my work, just just because we don't have Enterprise. So I remove a lot of the bloatware, like the Xbox Companion app and the Microsoft Store. But yeah. Certain stuff like OWA for Edge uses the AppX bundle, which can only be installed via the Microsoft Store. So it's it's a tricky relationship because they kind of make you have it, but then if it is a thing installing Candy Crush Saga, I don't want it, you know. Like,
yeah, this is true.
Like, just give me an EXE or an MSI file and I'll be good. But nope, it's not an option.
Well, if anyone wants to, there is a way to actually remove all the bloatware from PowerShell. Because normally when you right-click on it, I know Candy Crush you can, but a lot of the stuff you can't. You can't just remove it yourself. I mean, you can, but it's not as easy as just right-clicking and clicking delete. There are some commands you can run to remove the actual like root file and actually get it out of the computer. Since I did that with Candy Crush, I don't think it's come back. Let me just check it real quick.
Yeah, I tried using some programs like Windows 10 Spying, I think is what it's called. Okay. Or no, I forget what it's called. But there's a lot of programs, but I found the best success. They have a lot of PowerShell scripts out there, and you can tell the script what you want removed, like the Xbox Companion app and stuff like that. Yeah. And I find those work pretty well.
Yeah, it worked fine for me. And as I said, so far I've updated it twice since then, and Candy Crush has not come back. So I don't know, maybe we'll make a tutorial on that or something of how to run that stuff. There's already a bunch on YouTube if you want to look them up. It's pretty easy. You don't really need any IT knowledge. Just copy paste. You can get those off of there. Because yeah, it is really annoying. And some of them are set to auto open in the background, and it just becomes a pain.
I see. We're just talking about iPhones, though. Mm-hmm. I want to talk about how European regulators are hitting Apple with a fine over their iPhone water resistant claims.
Ah, someone pour champagne on it.
I don't know, but we'll see. So Italy has gone after Apple with a fine of about 10 million euros or $12 million for us in the States for misleading marketing claims. Obviously, $12 million isn't much for Apple. That's like pocket change, you know. But they claimed that the iPhone 8 was rated at IP67 for water and dust resistant, meaning it could survive up to 30 minutes under 3 feet of water. But these Italian regulators claim this is only true under special lab conditions with static and pure water conditions.
Okay. So if you like dropped it in a pond, it's not quite the same.
Oh, yeah. And they specifically named iPhones from the iPhone 8 up to the iPhone 11 Pro. And presumably this will also include the iPhone 12 line that was just introduced. They say that while Apple lists the IP67 and IP68 ratings for their smartphones, its support documents nonetheless advise users not to submerge their iPhones, which, you know, I kind of understand, you know, like, don't go looking for trouble. But if it's only under certain lab conditions, I think, and I could be misinformed on how these IP ratings work, but I'd imagine it would be better to look at it from a more realistic example. Like, say if I'm at the beach, salt water might interact different than, say, distilled water or pond water or, you know.
No, that is definitely true.
We can also talk about Apple if you want.
Yeah, what you got?
So iFixit, they finally tore down the M1 Max, which used the M1 ARM-based processor.
Oh, yeah.
That came in the MacBook Air and the MacBook Pro and I think the Mac Mini even. And, you know, they were just looking at it and they find it very interesting because this is a system on chip that not only has, like, you know, the processor and GPU, but also has the RAM on the same silicon, which makes it very small and very power efficient. But, you know, iFixit, they're known for being proponents of, like, you know, the right to repair and everything. And they say this probably, you know, continues Apple's direction of being very difficult to fix your own device.
As
you're not able to do RAM upgrades or replace it if your RAM does die. But a lot of the benchmarks for the ARM-based M1 have looked very good. They're just as good as Intel, if not better, in some benchmarks. And the Rosetta, what is it? It's like a translation layer between x86 and ARM. It seems to run very efficiently. And even when apps aren't native to the ARM architecture, they're able to run pretty well. So I think this is an interesting direction, as I know Windows has messed around with ARM, but if Apple can help push the industry in that way, I wonder if it might be an end to x86-based CPUs.
Yeah, it definitely could, especially if there's a some sort of software or some sort of way to translate older programs into ARM. That would definitely help kind of push manufacturers towards that area. Because I know a lot of people hold on to 64 and 86 just because it's what they're used to.
Well, and the interesting thing is most people don't know this, but there's a lot more ARM-based devices in the world, especially with IoT and smartphones, than there are x86. It's really the server market and the desktop and laptop computing areas that haven't had much success with ARM breaking into it.
Oh, gotcha.
But with Apple taking the lead on this, we could see, a lot happening because it is more power efficient. You get amazing battery life. They say it doesn't get nowhere near as hot as the Intel counterparts. Mm-hmm. The fan, barely turns on if it needs to. I'm interested to see, I'd love to have a longer lasting battery in my devices.
Yeah, I've actually noticed that they seem to have kind of capped the battery of laptops and phones. I don't know if that's just me, but I don't know. It seems like 5 years ago or 7 years ago, maybe now, they were always advertising the long battery life, and this battery is massive. It's freaking 5,000 megahertz or whatever. And then now, they're kind of getting smaller a little bit, 3,000 I've seen new phones come out with, or 4,000 or something like that. I don't know if that's because they're getting more efficient and they're able to actually kind of utilize that capability and just have a slimmer battery on the back. I'm not really sure, but it definitely seems like they're, I don't know, maybe it's just me.
I think part is we're hitting the battery limit, on the technology of batteries.
Yeah.
It's hitting a limit on how dense we can make them. But also, I think Apple has historically had way smaller batteries than Android counterparts. If you look at it, those will be 1800 milliamp hours, maybe 2000 in their XL.
Yeah.
But Android phones will have 3000, 4000 milliamp hour batteries. And it's because Apple, while they're not open source like Android, they're incredibly efficient with their code and are able to ramp down the processor when it's not being used a lot more efficiently. And, I think we're seeing that with the M1 Max because it is ARM-based, they're able to run stuff like iPad apps and iPhone apps natively on the laptop, where before that was impossible.
Mm. Okay. Yeah, I guess that kind of makes sense. So they are just kind of utilizing more breakthroughs in hardware rather than just beefing up the battery to tank the processing.
Well, it is the hardware, but it's also a testament of how efficient their coding is. I guess that was a big thing in the 90s with hackers and whatnot is, I can get two lines of code to do the same thing that 10 lines of code could do.
Yeah.
And that really should be the mindset of software developers. If you can make something smaller and more efficient, then why not? But a lot of times, these software developers are overworked and have to meet deadlines. I know specifically Microsoft employees, they don't have time to make things super efficient.
Yeah.
But I don't know. It's interesting. I think it's an interesting time in tech. We might see a change in the next 5 to 10 years, potentially.
Case in point, coming out with a 120 gig game.
Well, games are weird because they have so much textures. The problem is we're getting into these next gen graphics with ray tracing and 8K and 4K textures. Insane.
I was being sarcastic, but 120 is kind of large.
Well, for a game like Call of Duty Warzone, I don't think that's necessary.
No, it's really not.
But for Cyberpunk 2077, that looks like a beautiful game.
It does. That's going to be a massive game unless they really take some time to slim it down. Yeah, that's going to be pretty insane. And then if they start coming out with 8K VR games and stuff like that, they're going to be huge. Because the new consoles, they come out with a terabyte, right?
I'm not sure. I actually, I don't stay as in tune with the console space as I do with PC.
I believe the new Xbox is coming out with
a terabyte. I can quickly Google it if you want. Or DuckDuckGo it, I should say.
Oh, yeah. True. I believe it's a terabyte. But even then, that seems really small for a game console. Because, I mean, you can add, like, an external in the back or something like that, but, you know, what else are you going to do?
So, on the PS5, according to IGN.com, says it is a custom 825 gig SSD for internal storage.
That's so small.
But it says it has an expandable NVMe SSD slot.
Okay, so they give you that and you buy another one.
Yeah, and it supports USB external hard drives.
So. Okay, all right, well, yeah, I guess that's fine.
Oh, no, I agree with you. Games are massive. Like, you get 8 games and your hard drive's full, especially if they're all 100 gigs each.
Yeah, especially now. Like, games are huge. I mean, even 10 years ago, games were, you know, 20, 30 gigs, maybe even, like, 60 gigs on, like, higher-end games. Like, those are huge.
Well, if I'm not mistaken, aren't they floating a digital version that doesn't even have the Blu-ray drive anymore?
Oh, that I don't know. I did not hear they did away with any sort of drive. I mean, I know they're pushing hard for it to be that way, just digitized. But
the digital only PS5, it's about $50 to $100 less, it says.
Really? Okay.
You know, and I think that is the way of the future. But
it is, but that's still surprising. That's kind of like, you know, iPhone taking away the freaking headphone jack. Like,
I'd rather it be the same price with more storage, though, instead of $100 cheaper.
No, yeah, that's definitely true. Especially if it's just kind of like a Steam store type thing, even though Steam still installs, you know, the game on your computer. But if they kind of had, like, maybe critical files on your computer and then, you know, everything else offline, I don't know. That, yeah, 800 some gigs does not seem like enough space.
Well, the SSD is getting so fast, you know, your main bottleneck is going to be the disk drive. Like, disk drive technology has not grown well, has not aged well, I should say.
Yeah. I mean, I still like it just because it's another option, but I definitely understand. I mean,
well, no, even with the Xbox One, you put the disk in, it had to install first. Like,
yeah, well, yeah.
Instead of streaming from the disk, like in, you know, the old days of PS2 and everything, and now it's they're more and more like a PC. They're actually running AMD APUs in them.
Yeah. No, they definitely are. It's basically a desktop. Like, at this point, it's. I mean, you can browse the web. You can go on Netflix. You can play games. You're buying a desktop. It's pretty much the same thing. It's just a prefab desktop
that you can't do anything with besides play games.
I mean, no, like I just said, you can watch Netflix, you can watch movies if it has a Blu-ray drive. Like, you can do more.
So they put a Roku inside it.
I mean, kind of, yeah. Basically.
No, I'm just playing.
It's not as customizable, obviously.
If you want to talk about China, we can do that.
About China. Again?
Oh, you know my favorite topic is China. Oh, my
goodness.
China, China, China.
Actually, before you go into China, I do want to just mention, since we're talking about Microsoft here, Project Latte. Have you heard of this?
No, I have not.
So Microsoft's Project Latte, they are trying to bring Android apps to Windows 10 and have them interchangeable.
Kind of sounds like what Apple did with their M1 processor.
Yes. So Windows 10 is doing, or what Microsoft is doing, is they have this packaging called MSIX. And basically what it allows app developers to do is take their code for their Android app, put it into this package, which will translate for Windows 10. So any app that you have on your phone, as long as the developer puts in, you know, the time and effort to put it in this other package for Microsoft, they will have it in their store. And you can basically, you know, if you want Signal on your computer without a, you know, a middleman like BlueStacks or something like that, that's usually freaking glitchy.
Then, well, I just want to say real quick that Signal's not a good comparison. Signal has a desktop app native.
Okay. Okay.
If you, I'm not trying to shit on your parade, but, you know, bad example.
All right, fine. If you want Clash of Clans on your computer.
Oh, damn, boy.
Yeah, reaching way back.
Hey, Raid Shadow Legends, where you at?
I think Raid Shadow Legends has a desktop.
Oh, darn.
But anyway, yeah, I thought that was pretty interesting. It just kind of caught my eye as I was looking for some articles. But yeah, I think that would be pretty cool. Especially like productivity apps, I think would be amazing. Because there's some really good ones that I have on my phone that don't translate well onto desktop, or vice versa.
And most of the technology is already there. There's the, I think it's the MHL standard for HDMI, where you can hook it into like the USB port on your Android phone, and it puts it on a display. All the other things you need is just a port replicator, so you can hook up a mouse and a keyboard, and then boom, you're ready to go. Like, it shouldn't be that hard. And I think when you can bring the desktop apps and the mobile apps together, you can make probably an amazing experience.
Yeah,
I mean, kind of like what Apple's already kind of doing.
Yeah, I mean, just for productivity alone, like, that would be amazing. Like, I could see, like, myself using that. If I was given a work phone or something like that, I would definitely use that. That would be very, very helpful. Just to swap back and forth. Actually, speaking of that, you said, you know, just plugging it into and having a monitor. If people don't know, you can get PC sticks, which are, they're advertised as like, listen. They're advertised as like instant computers. They're not the best, but if you are like traveling around or something like that, let's say you go into a hotel, you can get a PC stick, which has Windows 10 on it, has a tiny little processor, like 2 gigs of RAM, blah, 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 all that stuff. All you have to bring is, you know, a mouse and a keyboard, and you just plug it into the USB port on the side of the TV, and boom, you have a computer that you can work off of. Just if anyone finds something useful from that, there you go.
So we can talk about China, you know.
Oh, China.
So researchers have uncovered a massive hacking campaign that uses some sophisticated tools and techniques to compromise networks of companies around the world. These hackers are from a well-known group that's funded by the Chinese government and are outfitted with both off-the-shelf and custom-made tools. One of these tools is called Zero Logon. This is something new. I didn't actually know about this, but it's a name given to a Windows Server vulnerability that was patched in August that can give attackers instant administrator privileges on vulnerable systems. So Symantec, they identified this group and they call them Cicada.
Cicada, yeah.
And they're, like I said, believed to be funded by the Chinese government, but they also have been, you know, used the monikers of APT10, Stone Panda, and Cloud Hopper from other research organizations that have been looking into them. This group is, you know, typical of what we see of these advanced persistent threats. You know, they actively engage in espionage style hacking since, from here it says, about 2009, and recently, you know, they've been almost exclusively targeting companies linked to Japan, but have also been looking at companies located in the United States and other countries, but most of them seem to have Japanese ties. So it's very interesting. These attacks they've been doing, they make use of DLL sideloading, which is a technique that occurs where they replace a legitimate Windows DLL with a malicious one. And they use this so it injects malware into legitimate processes, but it makes it harder to be detected by, say, like antivirus software and stuff like that. But like I said before, they're using Zero Logon, which is interesting because they describe it a little bit here. It says the exploit works by sending a string of zeros in a series of messages that uses the NetLogon protocol, which Windows servers use to let people log in to the network. People with no authentication can use Zero Logon to access the organization. It mentions stuff like Active Directory domain controllers, you know, and file servers. It says Microsoft has patched these Zero Logon vulnerabilities in August. Agencies like the FBI and Department of Homeland Security have urged systems to be patched immediately. Amongst the systems that were compromised, Symantec noticed a lot of them were domain controllers and file servers. They've also uncovered evidence of files being exfiltrated from these compromised machines. A lot of the industries they seem to be attacking include stuff like automotive, clothing, various conglomerates, electronic and engineering stuff. It says general trading companies. I don't know if that's like stockbrokers.
Yeah,
I'm not sure. Government, industrial products, service providers, pharmaceutical.
So everyone. And,
yeah, it seems to be everyone. And the pharmaceutical one's interesting because we have seen various other news articles come out about how China and Russia are trying to hack stuff like Pfizer, Moderna, and various other companies that are engaged in COVID-19 vaccine research.
So I
thought that was extremely interesting that that one was specifically mentioned. I thought some stuff was interesting. I'm not going to dive too deep into this part of it, but they when they were looking into these attacks, they saw some various digital fingerprints found in the malware and attack code. Mm-hmm. So Symantec said, security firm Cylance, my bad. But the third stage DLL has an export name called Fuck You Anti. What does that mean? I'm a little confused.
I don't know.
And then they have a bunch of other names like Quasar Rat, which it says was an open source backdoor that was used by Cicada in the past.
Okay.
But it says just the scale, because it mentions a couple other exploits, but it just says the scale of these operations and who they're targeting. This points directly to nation state backed groups. And it's not surprising that Japan and the United States are on the list, especially when it's linked back to China. You know, China hasn't looked too favorably at those the two countries specifically.
No, definitely not.
I don't know why they named it that. That's a little weird.
maybe it was lost in translation.
maybe.
But no, that is interesting because I've been listening to a few podcasts and news articles and stuff recently about China and how they're kind of trying to spread out over the world and such. And it is interesting because there was a defector not too long ago from China. He was like the chief information officer or something like that. He said that they're basically just trying to do whatever they can to gather everything that they can. He was like, it doesn't matter what the information is. He was like, China is just trying to get it. Like, they just want anything that's out there so that they can have superiority, which I thought was interesting because... Yeah, like a lot of this stuff is just it kind of seems random, but yeah, they're just trying to, at least from what he was saying, they're just trying to get like whatever they can from anyone that they can. But they definitely seem to be targeting, obviously, like U.S., Japan, those sort of countries.
Well, not to be fixated on China too much, but they have been known to steal intellectual property over the years. And,
oh, yeah.
And, you know, this seems to be what they're good at, is they can steal work of other people's and reproduce it relatively quickly, maybe slightly modify it, but... It doesn't look like they do a whole bunch of innovation on their own.
Hence the vaccine hacks.
Exactly. And you know, mm-hmm. this was also brought up, you know, Putin came out and he said there was the, he had some COVID-19 vaccine way before any other country.
Yeah.
And then researchers actually looked like it and they're like, this thing is garbage. You know,
they're like, just vodka.
It wouldn't surprise me. I bet if you injected enough vodka in your system, you killed the Which I am not recommending anybody to do. This is not medical advice.
We do not endorse alcoholism.
Only sometimes.
So anyway, before we get in trouble with Alcoholics Anonymous.
And China.
We're
don't at me, bro.
We're going to leave it there. Yeah, we're going to be recording one time, and all of a sudden we're just going to hear like... Like, be like, hello? Hello? Is that you pooping?
It's crazy how they use their great Chinese firewall to block a meme of him with Winnie the Pooh. Like, what? Ryan, put a video up. Put a picture up when we're editing. Like,
I will. It was a pretty funny. It was a pretty funny meme.
like, who is this man?
And they were like, no, fuck you. They blocked everything. that was actually interesting. They actually blocked some. I believe they blocked. Was it Minecraft servers? I believe it was like Minecraft servers.
So there's this. I know exactly what you're talking about. There's this Minecraft server because Minecraft has books where users can put information in.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so this one, I think it was some nonprofit organization. Let me look it up really quick before we wrap up. Mm-hmm. But they had a world where it was almost like a library. You log in as Minecraft and you can read these books, which they put a ton of information in. And China was like, we ain't having this. Block Minecraft. Like,
oh, my word. I don't know. I know it's not funny at all because it definitely is terrible for the people there. But I just find it hilarious that the government has gotten to the point where they're blocking games because there's too much outside information.
Well, and so I'm trying to find the name of it really quick, but the CNN article is talking about how there was banned works from various countries, you know, and from journalists who have been killed, jailed, or exiled by governments. This one specifically mentioning, like, in the Middle East was Saudi Arabia and Egypt. I'm trying to, what is the name of it? It had a very interesting name. I almost thought about logging in one time to see what it's all about.
I mean, those books in the game can hold a ton of information as well. You can have like tabs on tabs in those books.
Is it called Blockworks? Reporters Without Borders? They built it? Where is the name at? I don't know. It's very interesting because it provides these articles from, it says there's countries that silence journalism like Egypt, Mexico, Russia, Saudi Arabia, and Vietnam. But, you know, most people don't think about banning a game with blocks.
Yeah.
But, you know, it just shows that the ingenuity of these individuals. And
oh, yeah. I mean, yeah. It definitely shows how much they care as well, because that would take a lot of work. filling up Minecraft books.
It said it took 24 builders from 16 different countries over 250 hours to design and create the library.
Jeez.
So I said over a 3-month period, they used 12.5 million blocks in the game. Goodness so gracious.
Yeah, that's pure dedication right there.
Yeah, no, it's crazy.
Yeah. Well, anyway, we'll wrap it up there on that sad note. If you're listening in China, there is hope. All right. Okay, we're going to wrap it up there. Bye.